I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I was fascinated by all parts of show business.
Hello and welcome to episode number 26 of Varvet International. My name is Christoph Triumf, and if you are listening for the very first time, I'd like to give you an extra warm welcome on board. You might be wondering what to expect in this podcast, and in short, I can tell you it's long-form interviews conducted by me, a Swedish podcast host based in Sweden, but oftentimes traveling to the US or Great Britain to collect interviews. And one of those will poke your eardrums in a minute or three. The guests are for the most part in the entertainment industry and will discuss stuff like motivation, work process, and, well, life, I guess. You'll catch the drift, I'm sure. Before I'll let you try, I want to tell you that Varvet is sponsored by Uber, the new way of getting around in over 200 cities around the globe. And this podcast has a collaboration with the Swedish branch of Uber, so if you're in Stockholm or Gothenburg and still haven't tried Uber, you most definitely should do that now. Because if you sign up and use Varvet as a promo code, you will get 150 Swedish kronor to ride around for. I'll repeat, sign up now and use Varvet as a code, you'll get 150 Swedish kronor to Uber for in Sweden. That's a great deal, so please do that. And thanks, Uber. Okay, today's guest of honor is Ileana Douglas, famous actress with an extremely impressive resume. We'll talk more about her long career in a bit, but I'll drop a few of her movies just to remind you. She was in Goodfellas, Cape Fear, of course. She was in Ghost World and in the Larry Sanders Show, Ugly Betty, and about 100 or so other movies and TV shows. Nowadays, she also stars in Greg Polar's, yes, you know him from Varvet International, episode number 23, in Gary's TV series, Welcome to Sweden. And for listeners in Sweden, that series is on now on TV4 here and will reach NBC on July 19 in the US. We'll get to this in a bit, but Ileana also did a web series for IKEA for several years. She came to my temporary apartment in LA on a very sunny day in March, and we had a lovely time, as you'll hear in an instant. So, it's time to ask my editor, Lovisa, to roll the tape, please. How are you today?
I'm very well. It's nice to be here.
Could you describe the neighborhood that we are in? Are you familiar with it?
This neighborhood is called Beverly Hills Adjacent.
Okay.
meaning you're on the wrong side of Beverly Hills.
Okay.
You're not in the right side.
So it's
you should be, if you were north of here, you'd be in a pretty posh neighborhood.
Okay.
So but you're south, so you're not.
I should be up on the hill even.
Yes, you're okay. Living on the wrong side of Sunset. If you live north of Sunset, you'd be in a very posh area where all the movie stars live.
Do you have an accent?
Do you think an American accent?
Exactly, yeah.
I don't feel that I do. I'm from the East Coast.
Yes.
So I have a slight accent.
I would say that it's sort of a New Yorkish accent.
People think that. I spent a lot of time in New York, but then I also have East Coast. I've got three states mixed in. Got a little bit of Boston and a little bit of New York.
If you would exaggerate, just so I understand, how is a Bostonian accent?
A Boston accent's like that. It's very like in the back of your throat, talking like that.
Okay.
And then New York is more like in the front of your mouth, like talking like that. And then I spent also a lot of time in Connecticut, and that's like a lot of lock jaw, a lot of talking like that. Very upper class.
Okay.
Very, very white. Live in a very wealthy neighborhood. So I have all three. My mouth is moving all the... I'm going like that, and then I go like that, and...
Is there a Los Angeles accent as well?
No, I don't think there is.
No.
I think they call it just mid... I don't know why, but just a mid-Atlantic, just very straight, no accent. Okay. I know people... Now, where are you from? Are you from Stockholm?
Sort of, yeah. Close to...
So Stockholm people, I notice a little bit of an accent. Stockholm is sort of like New York. A little also more lower. People from Stockholm.
Ja, det kan du ha rätt i. Man låter liksom lite grann så här, va?
Yes, sounds very Stockholm. And then and then if you're from the north, it goes a little, sounds a little higher.
Hur pratar man i Norrland då? Jo, då pratar man så här. This is north of Sweden.
Seems to go slightly higher. And then you get into the city... And it gets a little lower.
Yeah. And in the south of Sweden, it's a really long country, you know.
Yeah.
In the south of Sweden, they speak like this. Jag kommer från Malmö. Hur är det med dig? Vad har du gjort idag, Iliana? Kul att se dig. Vad gör du för något?
I like that.
Yeah, you do?
Yeah. Well, I love Sweden, so I'm...
I know. What is it with you in Sweden?
I know. It's gone on many years. That's why I was like, finally, I'm actually doing... I think I just visualized it enough times. I didn't know anything about Sweden. And then a number of years ago, I started doing a show that sponsored by IKEA. I started doing a web series.
Yeah.
And everybody I worked with was Swedish, you know, all my executives... And all the people at IKEA, they were all Swedish, and everybody was incredibly nice to me. And I started learning more and more about the culture and watching Swedish films. And I just thought that the culture was really interesting and fascinating. The people seemed interesting. And then, you know, I never met a Swede that was in a bad mood or that yelled or... I just thought it was really fascinating.
Have you still today?
Never. Okay. Yeah, that's all of my dreams have maintained, because then I needed Swedish actors on my television show, Easy to Assemble, and so I was talking to a Swedish agent who knew Josephine Bornbosch, and we were trying to get her on our show, but it didn't work out. And then I said, you know, if a show ever comes up in Sweden, I'd love to go there. And then this show came up, and then I went and worked in Sweden, and it was weird. It was like, it was actually better than I had portrayed it on the show. I could not believe how nice everybody was. There was a dinner every night. Everybody was, I felt more at home there than I did in America.
But the first time you were in Sweden, that was in the summer, right?
I arrived, it was like a joke. I arrived on the longest day, on the... You know, summer solstice day. So it was arriving. Yes. And I arrived at the hotel and I was delirious. And then they, you know, took me out to the country and everyone's dancing. I mean, it seemed kooky. It was, and then we went back into the city, and then I think we all went out drinking all night. And it was complete, you know, obviously, you know, there was never got dark.
No, no.
So it's like midnight, and you're like, what time is it? 4? And it's like, no, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. So we were still out. And so the first couple days I was there, I didn't sleep at all. But everybody was so incredibly nice to me, I could not believe it. I was getting invitations for sightseeing and buying food and licorice. I mean, it was great.
Do you like licorice?
I love licorice. It's another... That was the other day. You know, in America, we take pictures of food that has not translated to Sweden. So they thought that was one of the weirdest things. I was in the supermarket and I took a picture of all the licorice because I've never seen, there's like 100 types of licorice. in the supermarket. And yeah. to a Swede, of course, they're like, yeah, so what? But to me, there's like two types of licorice in America.
I know.
That's it.
Shame on you, America.
Yes.
For us licorice lovers.
Yes.
Yeah.
What is the obsession? 50 varieties, chocolate covered, salty, not salty,
absolutely.
Hot.
Yeah. I have a theory that it has to do something with what you lack physically, like that it does something to us that we really need. Hmm. Like salt, perhaps we need salt, but we eat way too much salt in Sweden. But
yeah,
something like that.
I don't know, but there's... I love licorice. And different flavors. I mean, we could spend an hour talking about that. And they used to sell licorice at IKEA, but it was very controversial because they took away all the Swedish foods, and then the Swedes couldn't get their licorice fix anymore.
Oh, okay. And they still don't sell that.
No, there. They really reduced... I don't work with IKEA anymore, so I can't be a spokesperson. But yeah, they took it. It was very controversial. When they took out the big food section, they serve a few things now, yeah. just like the meatballs and the bread and, you know, the cracker, the flat, gigantic flat cracker.
Knäckebröd.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, when one reads up on you, as
yes.
I've done, something that's sort of recurring is the fact that you are sort of almost Hollywood royalty, or you were sort of born into it
yes.
by your grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about...
Well, he was a pretty famous actor, Melvin Douglas, and a two-time Academy Award winner.
Very, very handsome man.
When he was younger, yes. I mean, I thought so, too. Elegantly handsome.
Exactly.
As he got older.
Errol Flynn-ish, almost.
Yes, yeah. I would say. Some people say William Powell.
Okay, I don't know him, but yeah.
Another sort of 1930s suave,
okay.
sophisticated,
yeah.
erudite. And elegant, but he won two Oscars. This first one was for a movie called Hud with Paul Newman, and then the second one is Being There with Peter Sellers. But previously to that, he'd been in the Hollywood studio system for many years under contract at, you know, MGM, and was a famous, you know, leading man opposite Greta Garbo and many other, Joan Crawford, you know, on and on and on, many people. He did three films with Greta Garbo, and he just was amazing. So, you know, from when I was pretty young, before I even knew I wanted to be an actor, I was sort of sitting behind the scenes watching him act with pretty famous people.
Yeah.
So it was very exciting, and then it gave me a great love, probably of film history. Because, you know, I wanted to read about him and his career. And the more I would read about, you know, Hollywood history, it gave me a real love of movies. And I became a movie buff and sort of thought for many years just about being behind the scenes and being a writer. And then but opportunities came up also to act and to be a stand-up comedian and things like that. So I was always I've been going back and forth from being a performer to also being a writer.
Back then, when you were with him at his, when he was working, was that, I mean, was since when?
Well, I'm never good with years. I just wrote a book and I was trying to remember. So I think I'm about like 13, 14 when I was on my first movie set.
Okay.
And getting to meet people, you know, who I didn't even know how important they were, like the director, Hal Ashby and Peter Sellers, I knew Peter Sellers from as the Pink Panther, but to get to meet him in person and just to kind of see, it was like the Wizard of Oz. It was like seeing behind the scenes of how a movie was made. Seemed unbelievable to me, watching the actors and seeing them talk, and then the lights would go on, and then they would act. It was very surreal. You know, and then I watch people, and then as the next movie he took me on, which was called Ghost Story, it's the same thing. I was watching Fred Astaire in movies, and then there's Fred Astaire, and he's like really, really old. And it's like, it's a very jarring kind of experience, because I wanted to talk so much to Fred Astaire and ask him all these questions, but yet, you know, I had respect for him. I knew he was acting, and he was acting in the movies. And it was the same thing with my grandfather. I was developing almost like a pathological love of movies and movie stars from afar, but being too shy in real life to actually ask questions. So yeah. I've always been both a movie fan and a movie fanatic, and then, you know, also an actress myself.
If you would have had the guts to ask Fred Astaire stuff, what would the first question be?
Well, of course, it would have been something ridiculous, like about dancing, and because I just thought he was just the greatest dancer of all time. Yeah. And, you know, so I was nursing a love of musical theater at the time and wanting to be in musical theater and also dressing like Fred Astaire. So I would have asked him, where did you get your clothes? What kind of a cologne are you wearing? Or, you know, things like that. Things that you're just fascinated about.
That's
like,
a great question.
You know, so. Who was your favorite dance partner? Just things that you'd read, you know, that I had read about in books. And as I got older and I started to meet people, I've read so many movie books that I could actually prompt people on stories. You know, I'd say, I heard this story about, so people are always shocked that sometimes I'm able to draw people out because I've read so many books and I don't remember anything else except I remember things that I read. So I can call upon it at will while I'm talking to them. But we were talking about cologne and Fred Astaire. And I remember there was like I'd read in a book, a very particular type of cologne that he used, and you could only get it in London at one particular shop, and so things like that I was fascinated by.
That is fascinating. What kind of perfume do you wear?
I wear it's not a perfume, it's actually an oil.
Okay.
So, and
is
it's
that the new thing?
No, I've been wearing the same. I mean, as influenced by some of these people, I've only worn the same thing since I was 18 years old. I moved to New York City. It's an oil, and it's called Rain, and you can only get it at one shop in the world, and it's in New York City, downtown.
Okay, but you won't tell us which one.
No, because I don't want anyone else to
smell like me.
No, they can't. It's called the Fragrance Shop.
Okay, all right.
And it's been there, and if it ever goes out of business, I'll be in really deep trouble.
But but it's good that you talk about it now, though.
It's my one signature. It's a tiny little shop, too. The little bell on the ding-a-ling-a-ling. You go in. It's very tiny, and that's all they do there is they make these oils.
But it's perfect that you talk about it now, because then new customers will come in there.
Yes.
So you'll
say, I want to smell like
Ileana Douglas. Yeah. I did an interview just before you came. Well, I gave an interview just before you came where someone asked me what the difference between Swedes and Americans are. Hmm. What would you say?
There's, to me, profound differences in that part of the reason I love Sweden is that there's a great appreciation for nature. That sounds like a little thing. That sounds silly. Like, who cares? But here, everybody is so involved with their work and their job and getting ahead that it literally gets in the way of enjoying life. And I feel like that the greatest thing that Swedes have is an ability to really appreciate each day. Maybe because there's snow on the ground. I don't know. But it's, you know, when you're there, they seem to get more of an appreciation. I would have long conversations with Lena Olin about the bread and then we'd put the cheese and then the butter and we could go, you know, we'd go 15 minutes just on that. But if I did that in America, they'd be like, okay, whatever. Can we talk about what we're going to do today? So that's why I found Swedes to be very relatable in that way. Like they do their work, but they enjoy their work as they do it. And that's another thing. I think that Americans tend to be in jobs that they don't really like. Mm. And they seem to be kind of looking for the next better thing instead of taking a certain amount of pride and joy in what they're doing now. I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, it does, yeah. I mean, there are aspects of America that I really like, and politically, I'm not sure that I would say that it's a good thing that you have so many low-wage jobs. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But it does make life easier, like when somebody, that you have someone working in the restroom to sort of keep it clean and so forth, mm-hmm. or to park your car, or to sweep the sidewalks.
Right.
We don't do that so much in Sweden because it's so expensive to employ yeah. people. And also, if you're unemployed in Sweden, you're not going to be out on the street.
Right.
Probably. Well, that's at least how it's been. It's mm-hmm. getting worse. But maybe here it's more of a life and death thing for people to keep their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Because it seems like it.
Yeah.
It seems like it.
I just learned about food stamps. I'm not even sure what it is, but that you still... We had that during the Second World War.
But that makes it sound so backwards. We had that during the Second World War.
Yeah.
No, it seems ridiculous that, again, we're in a country where people can't get food or buy food or eat food. That just doesn't seem good in a culture. And you feel as if you wouldn't find that happening in Sweden. And plus, you know, just the people are riding their bikes. They just seem to care more about the environment. There's many times, I hate to say it, just mechanically things seem to be, you're like, oh, what an ingenious idea. Why don't we do that in America, you know? Why do we need five people to do one job that seems to be... I was saying just yesterday, because I was working in Las Vegas, and I came back, and it took as long to get through the airport both ways as it would have to drive to Las Vegas.
Okay, yeah.
So I said, you know, when I went to Sweden, I was making a joke yesterday. I said, when I went to Sweden, I got off the plane and my bags were neatly there. Everything was all lined up and orderly as if they knew we were coming. Picked up our bags, ping, going through. It was so orderly. If you live in Sweden, go this way. If you're visiting, you're going this way. I was like, oh, wonderful, pleasant, marvelous. You know, coming back to America was so harrowing. Mm. And again, you just see this lack of efficiency that we have going through security, that is, again, I would say, another thing that maybe Europe and Sweden seems to have. They you know, they seem to be an extremely efficient country.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah. But also, we didn't have 9/11. I mean... It would have been perhaps different if that would have happened in Sweden.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. Or I just think that they would have figured out a better, you know, there's great cynicism though when you're going through security, because it really looks like it's more for show than actual security. Mm-hmm. Whereas mm-hmm. you go to Europe and people have, you know, they're holding guns. Like, it feels more like they could actually be doing something. Yeah. And they only have two people that look like they know what they're doing, as opposed to we have 20 people that are talking to me about Robert De Niro. You know, like, I don't know if that's part of their security, you know, check. Yeah. They're like talking to you about movies. Oh, what are you here for? And you just, you know, you're chatting and you're like, you're thinking we're all just pretending that we're safe, but we're not really safe. I mean, I know we're not safe anywhere anymore, but it's all based on trust. But I would say that that's one of my, another check mark for Sweden.
Would you consider moving there?
Definitely.
Uh-huh.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I mean, yes. When I got back, when I was there the second time, everybody kept saying to me, oh, you'll see when you go there in the winter, that's when you're really, then you're going to see how horrible it was. And I was like, no, it's just as good. It's just as good. Mm. I can't believe it. This is crazy. As I said, I never ran out of talking to people. It's strange. I just relate to the culture, I guess. The design, you know, there's many, many things I could go. I would be boring. The great sense of Swedish pride, which Americans don't really have a lot of pride in our own country, I find, which is another disturbing thing.
Oh, how is that? Because I would say it's the other way around.
I think we do a lot of gung-ho, like, we're Americans, but we don't know about our own culture, is what I'm saying. Is like, we don't preserve films, we don't preserve movies and music and genres that we've invented and promoted, and so things like that. Food that we've invented. You can find it again in little pockets. And again, maybe it helps that Sweden is a smaller country, but there seems to be a greater pride in the things that they have invented or developed.
I was thinking that when this person asked me about the difference between Swedes and Americans, I also said that Swedes don't small talk.
Mm-hmm.
Have you found that to be true?
Yes. Again, that's another. I'm not good at small talk. So I'm much better at big talk.
Yeah.
Long talk.
You said that you came with your grandfather to the film set when you were really young. And you said also that it was before you knew that you would want to pursue a career as an actor, but actress. But when did you sort of get that idea?
I spent a lot of time living with my grandparents when I was very young. And they,
how come?
Just because we were very close, and that's, I think, what you did in it. Italian communities, you give away your children. No, I don't know. They just are passed around by a lot of Italian relatives. But I spent a lot of time with my grandparents who were Italian, and they loved the movies, you know, again, like movie fans. And we didn't, when I was growing up, I had sort of like a hippie upbringing, so we weren't allowed to watch television. We could only read books and pick up shells and, you know, things that hippies did. So consequently, when I went to my grandparents' house, you know, they had television and it was New York. So all I did was like watch TV and old TV shows. And I watched what my grandparents watched, and everything they watched was from the 1950s or the 1960s. So I developed this idealized version also of what being an actor was. Like, I thought being an actor was like you had to be a movie star. So I didn't relate so much to this idea mid-70s, late-70s that, you know, you could be Al Pacino or Dustin Hoffman until I kind of got into high school. That's probably more and more when I started to think that I wanted to be an actor. But I wasn't particularly encouraged to be an actor in any way, shape, or form. I mean, I really didn't know what I wanted to be, but I wanted to do something where I made a lot of money. Like that was my first thing, was like, I want to make a lot of money. But
why was that?
Because we didn't have any money growing up.
Okay.
And then when I would visit my grandparents, like, they had a lot of money. So I was like, oh, okay, there I have a television. And when I would stay with both of my, you know, with my grandparents, it just seemed like there was always food and TV and you go to baseball games. And I was like, you know, then I'd go home and I'd be back like reading a book, holding a rock or a shell. So I grew up like the total opposite of what my parents wanted. Instead of wanting to be a hippie too, I was like extremely materialistic. I wanted like a flashy sports car and all these things. And
who doesn't? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, that's, I don't know what other kids, if they had, you know, wanted to do, but that's, I wanted to have a lot of money, and I didn't have realistic ideas of what I wanted to be because I would just see movies. So I was like, I want to own a yacht. Like, I want to be that girl who's got the fur and the diamonds. Like, but I didn't know, they just seemed like people that had money. So, but then I started visiting my grandfather, I was like, oh, I could be an actor. But nobody really encouraged me in that way. So again, then I thought, well, maybe I'll be a writer, actor. But then acting seemed to come more easily to me. And it seemed to me like you'd make more money being an actor. So I think that's why I kind of went in that direction.
But your parents were not at all in showbiz, right?
No.
One was a teacher.
Yeah, they're both teachers. And then okay. my
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Dad moved out when I was pretty young, so I didn't spend a lot of time with him. So I was mainly raised by my mom. Mm-hmm. And she was a teacher, you know, working teacher, single mom. We didn't have a lot of money, you know, growing up. And so she was just sort of trying to put food on the table. So me, like, saying I'm going to be an actress was like, okay, whatever. Sure. I got to go to work now.
Were you the only child?
No. I had two older brothers.
Okay.
But as soon as I could, you know, and there was no sort of theater environment. But again, spending more time talking to both of my grandparents, it seemed like they were encouraging me going into being an actor. And so that's what I eventually did.
When was the first time that you sat foot on stage?
Well, the first job I got was actually my first job was at a dinner theater. I was working sort of behind the scenes. I got like a little cocktail-y type job I got hired as a cocktail waitress, not knowing anything about that, and was immediately like fired from that responsibility. But I was so upset that I cried and they made me a hostess so I could, like, because that was, I basically had to walk 100 feet and sit people. So they were like, all right, don't cry. And that's when I started watching the show and talking to the actors and then thinking, okay, I'm going to go in musical theater. That's going to be my thing.
Is this on Broadway?
No. This is in the sticks. This is in the country, in Connecticut. And then sadly, this dinner theater went out of business pretty quickly. And then I saw a little thing for children's theater, a youth theater, and I auditioned for that, and that was in also in Connecticut, and I got in it. So that was like a big deal for me because I was a kid. I was like 15, and so I moved out to be in this theater.
Okay.
And I never really, and that was it. Like, I was on my own, 15, working at this theater. And then that's when I went straight from there to New York City to go to acting school.
And what did you learn there?
That was like an incredible experience because I was, it was a theater group supposedly for inner city kids. And to get in the company was very, very difficult. And once you were in the company, you know, you work 5 days a week, 12 hours a day. And you learned, not only did you learn the show and learn, you know, audition for a part, but they switched you around. So you'd be in the costume department, you'd be in the makeup department, you'd learn about the light. So you'd learned about everything. And so I just got a lot of discipline doing that. And we got a bit of publicity because the program like really, really took off. So they had us touring kind of around, performing and, you know, parks. And they even one time they took us to a prison to perform, or we performed at an old age home. I mean, they were really, it was quite an innovative thing for the time. So we got profiled on television. It was like so it was sort of my first brush with like, oh, this could be cool. So with that, that's why I was like, no, I'm going straight to New York. So I went to acting school right after that.
Did you ever have like another plan?
No. I think that because, you know, I was delusional, like, which you have to be in order to become successful. Being in this Hartford, I talk about it quite a bit in my book, because being in this program, you know, we were such a huge, huge success. Given that opportunity to be in these shows, to be in these musicals, and to be treated like professional performers, even though, you know, we were 15, 16, and I stayed in the program for three years, you know, they treated us like grown-ups. And as I was saying, like, the shows did really well. Like, there was, we were profiled quite a bit, and we got a lot of publicity for how successful this program was. So I think, again, I was delusional to think, oh, well, I'm in the Hartford Stage Company Youth Theater. I guess you've heard of me, you know? So I had that delusion of going to New York, that where I already thought I was famous. And when I went to acting school, and I just, you know, I've said this quite a bit, like, I did not do well at the first acting school I was at. Like, they didn't get me at all. So I left that acting school, and then I went to another acting school. But that, and that one turned out to be much, you know, better for me. But, I mean, although I struggled quite a bit, no, I never had a backup plan. And I even, as I said, I briefly did stand up because I just thought, well, I could do that. Like, I never had this feeling of, like, I can't do that. I mean, it's more as you get older, I think, that you develop all sorts of fears. But when you're younger, you know, you're just incredibly driven, I think, to make it. And I don't know the way things are now. Like, now, I don't know if people are more driven to be a celebrity. But when I was growing up, like, I was driven to be an actor because I felt I had something important to say. So, again, that's, like, delusional, you know.
Yeah.
I was like, I gotta make it, because I've got things to say and things to do, and I was very lucky, you know. I found myself in situations where, I mean, I certainly didn't make it overnight. It took very long years, but I was always able to work and get in some theater program. Or I mean, I feel the worst for people that toil for years and just don't catch a break. But for me, the biggest break I ever caught was being in this Hartford Stage Company Youth Theater. Mm. Because as I said, I got this big taste of success, and then I got slaughtered at acting school, and I sort of learned more how to act. But I think that I was prepared for my success, very much prepared, because I already thought I was successful.
I get that with some people, and I sort of can relate to that as well, because when I finally, like, almost 40 years into my life, when I got a little bit of fame for mm-hmm. doing this podcast,
mm-hmm.
it was so natural to me, because I have always felt that I'm supposed to do something
mm-hmm.
that's going to make the world know that I'm a genius, or mm-hmm. perhaps not a genius, but I...
No, but that's a very important quality to have. And I don't know, I mean, again, because things have changed so much, I never had a desire to be famous so much as I had a desire to be heard. And I think that that's what you were saying, yeah. is like, yes, you need an ego. But my ego was like, again, was like, I'm a great actor. Like, people need to see me. I'm going to change people's lives. You know, like, that's how you felt. And in a way, that's like kind of sweet, you know.
Yeah.
But I never thought, like, oh, I want my picture on a magazine. Like, that wasn't what I... That wasn't part of any fantasy that I ever had. I mean, having money was certainly part of a fantasy. So I was like, wow, imagine getting to buy fruit. Like, that would be a big deal. You know, like, I still like it. I really appreciate it to this day. I'm like, that's...
I've got some fruit, but over there. 2.5 bananas.
That's good. That's a lot.
Thank you. I'm doing quite well. When the fame came, was it sort of, did you resent it or did you welcome it?
No, it somewhat happened overnight, even though I expected it. I was working, doing, got small parts in movies. And then when I did the movie Cape Fear, before it had come out, I had used to do stand-up. And there was a guy who'd seen me do stand-up. And so they had seen, in those days, you would, talk shows would see in advance of the film. And then they would, it'd be kind of a big deal. You'd want the actor that was going to be in the movie before, coming this Friday, this movie will be out. So this booker for David Letterman, for the David Letterman show, saw me in Cape Fear, and they saw the movie, and apparently Dave Letterman really liked the Cape Fear, and he was a huge fan of Martin Scorsese's. Marty had been on his show many times. And lo and behold, I got this call about, they want you on the David Letterman show, because the booker, his name was Hank Gallo, had seen me do stand-up. So he kind of convinced them that I could be a good guest. And then we did this incredibly long, he called me, and he said, listen, I think you got a shot to be on the show, but we got to do a pre-interview, and you've got to be funny. You've got to really, really be, can you handle it? Can we be able to handle it? And I was like, there wasn't an ounce. I didn't have an ounce of fear of me. All I was like, no, I've got to get on the David Letterman show. I was on the phone for 2 hours. I literally told every funny story that ever happened to me. It wasn't until, my nerves were after I was off the show, I was like, oh my God, how did I do that? But when you're in, I was like, no, I gotta get on that show. I gotta get on the David Letterman show. I gotta tell these funny stories, which I did. Gotta make David Letterman laugh, and then the producer was like, you did a great job. But riding home in the limousine, I was like, how did that? That's when, to me, I always get scared later.
Yeah.
Because I go, I don't know how I pulled that off. And then that's when I can't watch it. I can't, everyone's like, are you going to watch yourself? Or it's like, no, because I'll get ill. Then I would get nervous.
Have you watched it now?
No.
I will try to see if it's possible to.
Probably not. It was a lot. I don't know. Sometimes with those TV show. Well, now I can watch it because I can look at how I was look at how cute I was.
That movie must have been a huge.
It was. So overnight from doing the Letterman show and then the movie came out, it was instantaneously I became, oh, you're that girl from Cape Fear, because it was such a memorable scene.
The thing with the
cheek bite.
Yeah.
Again, bringing it back to Sweden.
Yeah.
Very, as I learned recently, controversial in Sweden. The scene was edited out because it was considered to be too violent.
Yeah.
I just learned that from when I went to visit the Swedish Film Institute. They thought it was too violent, and they cut that scene out. And then, I got a succession of movies, and so I was pretty lucky after that just to keep working.
Since then, I guess, you've had a pretty amazing career, right?
I don't know if I would call it amazing. I think it's amazing that I've always worked. And that's the important thing for me, is just to keep working. And I've done a variety of things, which is what I've wanted to do. I've been able to write and direct. And I know that starting out, I didn't think about, I'm going to do this because it's going to be a good career choice. I usually chose something. I mean, I remember right after doing Cape Fear, and I had a number of big movies out, and I got offered to do a television show, and people were shocked that I was going to do this television show. But I was fascinated. I just thought, I want to take advantage of every part of show business. And so I was always fascinated by that. And I think that that goes back to being with my grandfather. I was fascinated by all parts of show business.
Yeah.
So I wanted to learn what it was like to be on a sitcom, what all aspects of it, of working in show business are. And I think that that's, for me, that's the most amazing part, is that you look at everything I've done, and it's like, wow, it's like I've worked with just hundreds of really interesting people. And that has helped me out as I've gotten older, because I can, as I said, I can talk about them, or, you know, there's a lot of different types of genres I've worked in, or, you know, because I didn't really have a specific pattern of what I was going to do.
No, you're not a typical, like, character actor or...
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I'll get pegged sometimes as being, oh, you know, she's an interesting character actor. But I'm really, I've written and directed documentaries, and I've interviewed people, and I work now for Turner Classic Movies. I do hosting. I've done all sorts of things, and I also act, and I love acting, but I don't think I specifically feel like just a character actor.
No. But back in the stand-up comedy days, what was your material?
Oh, you want to hear like a joke, a politically incorrect joke?
Well, you don't have to tell one if you don't feel like, if you remember it, of course that would be cool.
Well, I would come out and I'd say something like, you know, here we are, it's, you know, autumn in New York. I love it. You can always tell when it's autumn in New York because the bums begin to turn yellow and fall. It's just wonderful. You know, there's no seasons in LA, you know, pilot season, like those type of jokes.
Okay. Yeah.
So I did well, actually, with my stand up. I had maybe a likability factor, but the lifestyle for me was just way too difficult.
In what way?
I mean, first of all, I just couldn't even barely stay up till 10. There was a club that was near my house, so I was like, that was about my level of effort. And again, my roommate did not think I was funny at all. I would test out my jokes. I'd go, okay, here's what I'm going to say. You know, and I would do my joke, and he'd be like, that is not funny. And yeah. I was like, I think it's funny.
Well, it's so
like,
hard.
Delusional.
Yeah.
But I just had the, you know, again, you just had that ability to get up there. But what I didn't like was, again, the pre-nerves before the show. And then after the show, they'd say, all right, well, now you're going to come back at 10. And I was like, come back. I'm done. I'm like, you know, I had no desire in, like, learning how to be a great comic or delivering jokes. I did, to me, like, to tell 10 things and they laughed was like, well, that's success. That's,
yeah,
like... But that was the actor part of me. I wasn't really ever kind of a comic. But then as I got older, I was able, again, to use that skill sometimes of being a comedian when I was doing some of these sitcoms, because, you know, you really understand audiences.
If I would ask you to tell me what people in your life that have sort of been most instrumental for you as a person, who would they be?
Well, I mean, of course, the obvious people are, you know, are my grandfather, but my grandparents had a strong influence on me just in terms of their work ethic. So I saw that. I mean, to watch my grandfather, who is, you know, in his late 70s and 80, you know, working in films and learning lines, it's like you see the stamina that it takes to have that kind of a career. And then, obviously, early in my career, you know, Martin Scorsese took great. He was really a mentor for me and gave me a lot of confidence. Again, like, just, you know, acknowledge the fact that I knew a lot about movies, and he gave me confidence. You know, he'd say, you know, you're like a, you know, you're a born director and you have good instincts. And, you know, when somebody like that says that to you, you begin to feel it a little bit. And then also working with Gus Van Sant, like, he, when we were working on the set, like, again, we would talk about what shots he was going to use. And again, I noticed that other actors, they just weren't interested in that. They would come to the set and we'd be in the scene and the scene would be great. But I would want to know, you know, as soon as he would talk to the DP, I'd say, well, what are you guys talking about? And he'd say, oh, nothing. It's just, we're talking about the lens. And what I was like, oh, there's different lenses. Oh yeah. Well, this means this and this. And I was like, oh, that's so fascinating. Like, I was truly, it wasn't a put on. I was fascinated by every aspect of filmmaking. I was really interested in it, like what the light would do. And I don't know if that, again, comes from reading so much about movies, but I was fascinated by the behind-the-scenes stories as well as the acting on set. I don't know why. I was really, really interested in, like, the sound. I'd say, what are you doing? What is that? What does that mean? Or, you know, I would talk to them about sound. Or so I got to know every, you know, people more and more on the set. I remember Tadai 4 was the first time I remember wanting to wear a certain thing, and I couldn't wear it, and I was sort of disappointed. And then when I got to the set, I said, I get it. We're all in the same color scheme. And I said, and the room is blue. Okay, all right. So it's not up to me, like, I want to wear the pink dress. It's like it has nothing to do with that. It's like they're painting a picture. And that was so, I began to understand again. And then that made me, like, I felt like I was in the know. I'm like, see, oh, I get it. I know why he's wearing an orange shirt. And I would see that other actors, they had no clue. And so that it just felt like it was like my own little secret. And then more and more, I just found as I was working, directors would just always be including me. I just found myself always being included in decisions about what the shot was going to be, or who was sleeping with who was fighting with who. It was always, everything would start out like, I really shouldn't be telling you this, but, and I would always be like, but I was the perfect person to tell, because I had absolutely no interest in gossip. I was absolutely fascinated in how that made the movie behind the scenes just as interesting as what was being filmed, if not more so.
I have a theory that great actors need to be genuinely interested in other people.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's true?
I don't think so. Not necessarily, only because I actually feel the opposite. Whereas, like, I feel that sometimes great actors are better off, you know, being dumb, you know, just doing their thing. Because it's more like the more you care about other people, I think that you can lead to, you know, being depressed. I think that's why, but that's a natural director's instinct is to create an atmosphere on the set and to feel as if you want everybody to be happy. But those are, to me, those are complex feelings where sometimes I think you're better off just, I want to be the hero, and, yeah, and having your mind maybe be empty. It's people that think about things and worry about things that are more, to me, like, you know, the writers or the natural directors. I mean, of course, I see what you're saying in terms of caring about people is like a natural pathos.
I'm not sure that I'm talking about care, really, but interest or fascination, because you have to pick stuff from them in order to portray.
Let's put it this way. Yeah. My favorite people that I have worked with and that I admire are that way. You can tell that they are interested in the human condition. And the people that I've worked with that are not interested in the human condition, I do not find them as compelling to watch on screen.
Uh-huh, okay. I'm thinking also that you must have worked with many, quote-unquote, assholes.
No, I've been very lucky.
Oh, you have?
I've been, like, incredibly lucky. I also tend to see the good in people.
Yeah.
But very few times I have worked with people, you know, not that they're assholes, as you said, but that they're thinking about other things, that they're doing this movie, but they're possibly also interested in other things, and they're unreachable in a way. And that's hard for me because I like to be, you know, interested in the person and have some connection to them, because I think it makes the scenes better. And sometimes you meet people and they're just not going to engage with you. And I find that to be challenging, but yet sometimes you see people and they, you know, they're very famous or they've got other things going on and they just don't have the time to be interested. And I find that hard, you know, but I try to sense that right away. Early on, I used to get my feelings hurt because I would project, like, oh my God, that person's going to love me. We're going to be doing care. They probably want to read scenes with me. Probably have a scene book out. They'll want me to be in their next play. They'll probably invite me to their house. I mean, I would have this whole thing projected so that by the time they'd meet the person and they like wouldn't know my name or if I'd been in anything, or I'd be like, I was shocked. I was just like stunned.
Are you talking about Robert De Niro now?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. No, he's a person who's obviously truly interested in the human condition.
It would have been rather interesting if he didn't want to know your real name.
Yes, yeah. That would be bad.
Yeah. I've found a new favorite question.
Yes.
So far I haven't got one single yes. Have you reached your full potential?
No. But at least I know what it is, and it took me many years to do that, to find my full potential, because I had to kind of figure out, you know, that, as I said, that both sides of myself. And when I wrote this, I just finished writing this book, which will be out in December. People can buy it. It's called I Blame Dennis Hopper, and it's a life inside and outside movies, stories about my working in the movies. But it was once I figured out putting both of those sides together, I figured things out. And then so now I feel as if I can get to my true potential. I feel my own theory is that you cannot reach your full potential until you know who you are. And sometimes when you're younger, as we were talking about, you know exactly who you are, because life hasn't gotten in the way yet with all sorts of dramas and girlfriends and boyfriends and people die. What happens is that everything gets cluttered. But I feel like when I was very young, I knew exactly who I was and exactly what I wanted to do. And then life sort of gets in the way for me personally. I don't know how other people feel. And then it's taken all these side roads on the road trip of my life. I took all these side trips because I was really wanting to experience a lot of things, and now put it all together. And now I feel like I could certainly reach my full potential. And if I didn't reach my full potential, I would feel like I had a hell of a life. And I think that that's the secondary part of your question, is that you really have to feel, when your head hits the pillow at night, like, I've had a great life. And that to me, like, if you feel that, then I feel like that the second part, did I reach my full potential, it becomes not as important. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a very good answer. Thank you.
You're welcome.
What do you have planned ahead?
Well, as I said, I just finished writing this movie book. And that'll be out in December 15. And then I continue to work on Welcome to Sweden.
Yeah.
Which is really exciting. I've been trying to push to go get over there one more for our press. And then but hopefully the show will do well here too.
And now the press comes to you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then I also work for Turner Classic Movies. I do on-camera hosting. We've got our film festival, which is coming up March 26th.
That's going to be over when the people hear this.
Okay.
But well, maybe there's one next year.
We do it every year. They can always go to the Turner Classic Movies website and
very good.
Look up people that I've interviewed.
Perfect.
Yes.
And that's it?
And I just finished shooting a TV pilot with a wonderful comedian named George Lopez.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Very, very funny guy and very interesting and deep. And again, very, it's kind of a different thing for me to be working with him, and I loved it. It's really interesting. Comedians are fascinating for me.
I've heard his name, but I can't say that I've seen his comedy. I'm not sure if I have.
He's had a television show for many years, and his stand-up is kind of in the tradition of somebody like Richard Pryor. He talks about his ethnicity quite a bit, being a Mexican-American, and his childhood, very interesting childhood. And his comedy is very dark, but very, very funny and relatable, and he's a fantastic comedian.
Do you have, like, in terms of being directing stuff?
Yes, I do. I have a script that I'm, and then I will have reached my full potential once I've written a script that I'm working on. But I have to take acting jobs, pay the bills. But I have a script that I want to direct and not be in, just direct. And once I direct that, I will have reached my full potential.
And it's going to be fantastic, or?
I know it's going to be fantastic. The hard part is we'll be getting some financing for it.
Yeah.
That's always a challenge. But again,
is it about you?
No, it's about a relationship with it's a romantic comedy involving three people. That's all I can tell you.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Would you like to recommend something? Anything?
Can I say the tea at the Hotel Diplomat in Stockholm?
Of course you can.
It's the greatest tea in the world. People should go there for the breakfast. It's like the greatest. This became the subject of many discussions with me and Lena Olin. The bread at the Hotel Diplomat. I don't know. Maybe somebody can tell me out there, because each time I've been there, I swear I'm going to ask the hotel where they get their bread from, and then I forget. But it tastes different than any bread I've ever had in my entire life. And it's huge.
It's not a flatbread.
No, it's like it's gigantic. I mean, the bread is, it's like 4 feet long. It comes like a gigantic loaf of bread. And it is, and people were making fun of me on the set until they taste, then they brought the bread to the set. They put it in a scene. And everyone's like, you know, you're right about this bread. And then the next morning, I got up early and there was everybody from the cast eating the bread. And then the director thought it was so funny that he ended up writing a scene in the show where my character is trying to, he hides the bread in our suitcase so we can go home. So that's what I'd like to recommend. The tea, it's a really interesting kind of a mix of tea at the Hotel Diplomat and the bread that they serve for breakfast.
Who do you think has an interview on Varvet?
Well, I mean, I guess the obvious would be, have you interviewed Will Ferrell?
No.
He's got Swedish connections.
I love him. Can you set that up?
No.
No.
Amy Poehler.
I'd love that as well. Can you set that up?
No, I'm not doing, I'm not doing so well.
No, well, but that's fine.
I know. What about another? He's a famous podcaster, Adam Carolla. That might be interesting. He just wrote and directed a movie, and he's a very popular comedian and podcaster. Yeah. That might be good.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for the water.
Did you have a good time?
I had a great time. You're Swedish. Why could I not have a good time?
Yes, that's the laughter of Ileana Douglas. Such a wonderful guest. We had a great time. And if you would like to follow her future endeavors, she seems to be sort of active on Twitter. Her name there is Ileana Rama. And, well, if you Google her name, you'll find that. And if you Google Varvet International, you will probably find the contact information for us as well. So it's time for me to say thank you for the last time to Uber for sponsoring the show. And I'd also like to thank Lovisa Olsson for editing and to Christina Jörling-Biro for producing the show. And I should also, of course, thank Greg Poehler for setting us up with the magnificent Ileana Douglas. That was super nice. Thank you very much. And listeners, please send us an email or something. You'll find us on the internet. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.